Hello and welcome to The Stack. This week I visit the largest magazine archive in the world, HiMag. Plus, I speak to one of the founders of the coolest newsstand in São Paulo, and film journalist Matt Glasby on his new book about horror, perfect for Halloween. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, I speak with Roberto Meirelles from Banca do Quiro, a charming newsstand in my hometown, São Paulo, plus film journalist Matt Glasby. But first, I finally went to visit HiMag, the largest magazine archive in the world. Founded by James Hyman, a regular here on The Stack, I had the chance to peruse the vast quantity of titles there. At the moment, HiMag has a crowdfunder on their website to help them to survive. It's such an institution. Do go to their website to help. It's HiMag.com, HyMag. But first, here is James with more.
So we are in the stockroom in Woolwich. Now, this place was actually owned by the British Library, and before that, it was a cannon factory in the wars. And it's a warehouse where they store all materials for media, so film, TV, broadcast stuff. People do a bit of editing and film and production work out of here. And it is also home to the world's largest collection of magazines that belongs to myself and HiMag. And also we have other collections that come under that umbrella, like where you are standing at the moment is the Cuttings collection of Edda Tasiemka, who is a remarkable lady, who was rather, sadly passed away. So Edda Tasiemka had this unbelievable Cuttings collection. It was a business of hers where anyone or anything, whether it's, I'm looking at one here, crime, police, a person, a celebrity, a country, politics, sport, fashion, anything you can conceivably think of is a Cuttings file. And that is, again, unbelievable, rich, valuable content that when people come and access this stuff, whether someone's doing a degree, they're writing a book, they're doing a TV series, they are blown away because it's not a simple, oh, it's just a Wikipedia entry or a couple of articles on Google. It's deep. So that is what we have here. Unbelievable, copious amounts of rich content.
Just on my eyesight here, close to us, there's the Eurovision Song Contest file. There was another one for Jean-Marie Le Pen. I mean, it's just very varied, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, and that Eurovision Song Contest, I'm sure there were several of them. And I'm sure that also the people who hosted it, who performed in it, you know, ABBA, who won for Waterloo, there'll be files on them. There'll be files on the individual people in ABBA. You know, Arafat, look, we're just looking here, religion biographies, all the royalty, cycling. As one amazing lawyer who came down here to look at this said, you pick up one of these files and it's like a PhD.
And James, one thing that surprised me, I mean, as I said, even though we spoke many times in Monaco, but it's my first time here physically, it is very different looking at a magazine, not just at the cover, but the inside, you know, the different font. It's just emotional, if I may say, you know, as a first timer here.
Look, it's very emotional. I have nothing against digital. Physical and digital need to contwine together. The physical, touching something, even subconsciously smelling it, looking at it, as Jeremy Leslie, the revered Jeremy Leslie, who we all love so much, he said, you know, it's not just, as you're saying, the cover. It's the sort of the context around it, all the content around it, the adverts, the letters, there's little markings. It is very emotional because you're seeing the real zeitgeist of any moment in history.
I mean, exactly what you said about the zeitgeist, because then I was looking at the magazines, there was a couple of arena titles, and the covers were very kind of bright, very David LaChapelle, quite sexual at times. And I think, okay, maybe this wouldn't translate for 2020 for some reason, but you know, it was a time. It was a time in history.
Look, it's a time, and history should never be forgotten because, you know, the past makes the future. So you need this stuff. Some of it may be controversial. Some of it may be un-PC. Some of it may be dated. But, you know, it's so important to preserve all this stuff so people can learn from it. They can study it. They can access it. They can reference it.
And James, this place is just amazing, but I'm sure it's quite costly as well, to take care of all of this. Tell us what's happening with HiMag and how can the listeners of The Stack can help as well, because I'm sure they're big fans of magazines like us.
As you quite rightly say, it is costly to maintain and conserve all this material because it is not only the world's largest collection of magazines in the Guinness Book of Records, but we hold other collections like the Edda Tasiemka one I told you about with all the cuttings. So we've launched a crowdfunder appeal. Launched it last week. If you type in crowdfunder HiMag, you'll find it. And we really need to hit our targets so this material does not disappear, doesn't get lost, because we have so many people who come down here and pay to access this, whether they're students, creatives, academics, people, journalists, authors, all type of people really value this content. So, you know, very simply, I mean, if 20,000 people around the world or your listeners were to donate, for example, £20, we'll have done it. And it would be unbelievable. And then it can let us go to digitize it all, which would just be, you imagine all this content digitized and accessible. But if we don't reach our target, it's very risky that all this is going to be lost. So really, anyone out there, if you can donate, you can share and encourage others to do the same, and just let people know about how important and precious. You may have experienced it yourself, or you may want to come and experience it, but by donating just a little amount, it could be saved.
This whole idea of digitization, I mean, this is quite important as well, because as you said, you have the biggest magazine archive in the world. So I think it'll be good as well for people from other countries, especially, let's be honest, we're here in London. There's been so many great British magazines, and I'm sure people are interested, looking at old copies of The Face or many other titles. Even I was so emotional when I saw Smash Hits, because I've heard so much about it, but I never seen actually a proper physical copy in front of me. It looks great. It looks great, I have to say.
It's amazing. I take it for granted that a lot of people, when you see pictures about us, see videos and hear us, I hope it really enthralls everyone. But coming here, as you say, seeing it, touching it, feeling it all, you need to preserve that stuff. And around the world, absolutely, people I know want to access it, because we have people from all around the world who do come and visit. Only yesterday, ID ran a piece on us in Italy, and we had thousands of new followers, all from Italy, who were, not only donating, following us on social media, but clamoring to come and access this material.
And I was going to ask you mentioned ID there. You have quite a close relationship with the fashion industry, perhaps. I'm sure that people come here for inspiration, for their campaign, or just kind of a little study about the past as well.
Fashion is one of the biggest things that people want to come and research and look at. We have lots of brands, designers, makeup artists, stylists, who just come here, and again, they contribute, they pay, and they come and look at stuff, or they may have a specific brief, looking for, let's say, McQueen-related material, or their own heritage as a brand, or other brands. But yeah, fashion is really probably the biggest area where people are most interested, and there is huge demand. Again, dare I say, you just don't want that to disappear.
No, definitely not. I mean, you have an impressive collection of Vogues, of Harper's Bazaar, and many other iconic titles as well. Even the rarer ones. Tatler, right. And of course, I had a personal favorite, the Vanity Fair, I think from 92, with Madonna and Herb Ritz on the cover. Yeah. That's valuable.
Exactly. Imagine going online and just searching by Herb Ritz in Vanity Fair, or anything Herb Ritz did in this title, in a specific year with a specific person. Again, the technology is there, that once this material is digitized, it's incredible the level of research. You wouldn't have to spend those 7 days actually finding the magazines. You can spend those 7 days going through all your results and cross-referencing, and the genesis of Herb Ritz's photography, how he relates to other people. So the dream and the vision is to really have all this digitized and accessible to the world. And everyone, again, you've got to donate to keep it alive.
And do you have plans, depending on what's going to happen? This is kind of already a museum, but to make it even more open to the public in a way. Of course, depends on the circumstances. But do you have plans? Looking at the future.
I would ask Tori if she wants to answer that. Tori, who is incredible. Do you want to answer that one about the museum?
Our ultimate dream is to have a magazine museum accessible for everyone, so people can really sort of see and sort of feel the kind of tangibility of magazines. So it kind of complements the digital, really. We're all about the physical and digital.
The physical is important. You know, you go to museums. I was at the Design Museum last Sunday and we loaned them some stuff in there about Acid House. And, you know, they tell a story. You know this. Physical magazines,
the smell of them,
the touch, the tangibility. You know, they're almost like us. They get damaged. They get ripped. I mean, I ruined a very rare ID the other day. I had a spare. Idiot. I spent a fortune on issue 3 and I tried getting a mark off. I damaged that thing. You know, those things are brilliant, and they're narrative. They tell the story.
Talking about the smell of magazines, actually, I got to be honest, James.
My favorite smell.
Well, maybe I will. Okay. You gave me some inspiration. But actually, it smells pretty good here. I had this impression, oh my God, it's going to be a bit kind of stuffy and dusty. But the quality, because I've been to other smaller archives in my home country, in Brazil. You know, it's nice. They had some nice titles, but everything looked quite old and kind of damaged. But God, the quality of your titles is pretty good.
We've looked after them. I've kept them away from sunlight like gremlins. And, you know, looked after them, treasured them, kept them again, conserved them. And that, you know, again, I'm harping back to keeping us preserved, but that comes at a cost. So, yeah, we look after them. And if you want to know what my favorite smelly magazine, it probably isn't one of those ones like a Vogue where you get those perfume samplers in it. What would be my favorite one? I don't know. I can't answer that.
Do you have any titles that, I mean, you have so many, but do you have any kind of titles that you are actually looking to have it here? Or do you have, I mean, you have almost all of them.
It's infinite almost. You know, there's endless titles. There are things I can come. I think this collection, like music, you'll always discover more. Everything will always be unearthed. That's beautiful. That's great because, you know, who wants to know everything? I certainly don't want to know everything. I love learning and discovering. And I think you don't want to be the know-it-all. You don't want to have it all. There's always more to be unearthed and discovered. Zines in themselves are just endless. I mean, I love that.
Yeah, you've shown me one today.
The unknown. I mean, that's beautiful. And in fact, the unknown is so beautiful. When people come here and they're doing their research, what often sparks the most amount of joy for these people is not the predictable, oh, is it going to be in, say, magazine? I don't want to prejudice a magazine, but, you know, it's when they find stuff that they were least expecting. I mean, today we had some people looking at McQueen-related material and they were like, whoa, I didn't even know that existed. So in that magazine, that's the beauty.
Very much so. And I was looking, even in a funny way, you have old British mags like Nuts, which, you know, suddenly they became so trash and people say, of course, Nuts.
But that's a period in time.
It's a period in time. And it was like, wow, again, was there...
Don't just look at the busty women on the cover. Go in there and you would probably find some really fascinating, you know, adverts, the cars, the wallpaper, all the sort of ephemeral stuff away from what you think you would normally want to look at. And that, you know, that could be an amazing bit of typography, amazing bit of design, a content, an image.
And I'm glad to say as well for our listeners that you have the whole Monocle collection here as well. Probably more than what we have in the office.
We have the whole Monocle collection, issue 1 to present day.
That was James Hyman from HiMag, the largest collection of magazines in the world. I did spend quite a long time there perusing some of my titles. They have classic titles. I had a copy of Vanity Fair from 1992, a Madonna photographed by Steven Meisel. Amazing. Please visit their website to support them. HiMag.com, HYMAG. Let's move on now to my hometown of São Paulo to talk about Banca do Quiro, a new stand that also serves as a place to grab a drink. Quiro, the first sweetshow in Brazil. And of course, some cool Brazilian titles as well. I spoke to one of the founders, Roberto Meirelles, to explain the concept.
In our new stand, we sell, in addition to the traditional Quiro flavor, some exclusive products that we only sell there, with special recipes and packaging. We also have Quiro on tap, so you buy or you take your own growler and refill it. And we also sell books and magazines. And I'll tell you why. The new stands are part of São Paulo's history. They are a very important symbol. They acquired a very cool purpose to our society. In 1986, a law determined that one-third of São Paulo's newsstands should be owned by widows, citizens with disabilities, and elderly people. And newsstands have always had an important role in the publishing market, but it's sad to see the situation that many of them are in today. And when we first saw the kiosk, it was very old and badly maintained. It sold candies, cigarettes, it had more than 300 types of magazines. And the owner told me that some items went for more than 6 months without selling. So they did not keep up with the change in the market and sold products that did not interest the public in the region. And she was desperate to rent it. And now it's necessary to rethink this space to keep it alive. And that was our big challenge. How we would take ownership of the place, innovate, and at the same time contribute to development of the cultural market. And we wanted to have our own store, a space where we could be close to our customers and present our work. And we identified a lot with Pinheiros neighborhood. That's where our office and many restaurants that sell Kiro are located. But the rental price is very high. So we came up with this idea of renting a kiosk. In addition to having a lower cost, we would be in the middle of the street. I mean, you don't have to go through a door to enter a newsstand. So it's perfect for approaching people and presenting our drink.
Well, that sounds perfect. And Roberto, just out of curiosity, you know, I follow a lot the world of magazines as well. I mean, which kind of magazines are you selling there? Because I know the publishing market have been affected in Brazil in recent years as well, but there are still quite a lot of cool titles, and I think it's nice to talk about that as well.
When we rented the kiosk, we partnered with Inesplorato, a company specialized in knowledge curation, to select which publications would be sold there. And like traditional stores, we chose not to offer 1,000 titles. The goal was precisely to help people choose the next book they would read based on their personal interests and issues relevant to society. So in our newsstand, there are only 15 titles available. We give priority to authors who are part of groups that are underrepresented in the industry. And when you get there are the books, and next to them, there's a piece of paper, a small poster, explaining why the book is there, why you should read it, why this book is relevant, who would like it, and how this book can make you a better person.
That's amazing. And can you give us perhaps two or three titles or from the magazines or books that you have it?
Yeah. In Explorato, they change the books that are selling in the kiosk every 4 months. So they choose a theme and they curate the books based on the theme they chose. So for example, we have most of the books are from Brazilian authors. We also have books for children. I have to see the names in English because the books they are Brazilian books. I don't know if they were translated, but we had also books that are some biographies about interesting people and people that have some relevant issues here in Brazil. We had a book, it's from the author Stefano Mancuso, which is called The Revolutionary Genius of Plants. It's a new understanding of plant intelligence and behavior. So we have all kinds of books, biographies, fiction. What is important for us is how people will engage in social issues when they read it.
That was Roberto Meirelles from Banca do Quiro. If you're in São Paulo, make sure to pay a visit.
And to end the show, let's talk about one of my favorite film genres, horror. Film journalist Matt Glasby has always been obsessed with the genre and just published a new book called The Book of Horror, an introduction to the scariest films ever made. We also discuss why so many people are fascinated by horror.
My favourite genre, actually, I think probably since I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I started to, you know, at that age, you're just kind of feeling your way in the world. And I think it occurred to me the world was darker than the fairy tales let on. And so you sort of find the horror books out there, Stephen King, things like that, and you start to see some of yourself in that. And after that, it becomes a kind of addiction, you know, you just keep trying to find the next thing to be scared of. So, yeah, it's been a lifelong obsession for me.
And I mean, you as a film journalist, maybe you can tell me this. I mean, of course, you know, there's classic horror films from the 70s. But I think they're like film journalism in general, they're appreciating horror. You know, when you look at the daily newspapers or the magazines, you know, they're covering some horror films like if it was the latest Marvel in a way, which I think is a delight for people like us, you know, that love horror.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, horror has never been bigger than it is right now, which I think there's loads of reasons for. You know, just look around you at the world. Also, things like It, Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 made over $1 billion at the box office. So it's never been bigger. But also, I think that most film critics are secretly horror film fans, because I think horror films do something very pure, so that if you love cinema in general, you're really going to love horror films.
Well, absolutely. And that's your idea for the book as well, because you analyze what makes certain films scary, because that's the whole point of horror. And, you know, we have to say not all of the horror films make us scared in a way. There are quite a few flops here and there. But was there your intention in the book, you know, analyzing why do we feel certain things when we watch a couple of films that you've selected there in the book?
Yes, there's lots of books about important horror films, or, you know, horror films that sort of changed the history of the genre. But there's actually no books about which are the scariest horror films ever made and how they work. And I think as a fan, often you don't really care if something's important to the genre, if it's did well at the box office. I think the question you ask if you're going to watch something on a Friday night is it going to scare me? And so I wanted to collect together the scariest films from across the globe. There's films from Indonesia, there's films from Iceland, as well as, you know, the obvious choices from Hollywood, so that there's a kind of Bible of scary films. And if you flick through that book, put your finger on any page, you're going to find a film that will hopefully scare you.
And the book looks very beautiful as well. Incredible illustrations, if you can tell us a bit more about that as well.
Yes, so we're trying to replicate the experience of watching the film and of being afraid. And to do that, if you've got stills from the film, it's quite a safe way of doing that. So actually, the book is illustrated with beautiful black and white illustrations by Barney Baduano. And I think that those illustrations have a kind of mood, they have a kind of melancholy. And actually, they're really frightening, some of these pictures. And I think that adds so much to the book as a whole, because it makes it more experiential. It's actually possible, perhaps not as a grown-up, but certainly keep this away from your children, to pick up that book, look at the illustrations and be as frightened as if you were watching the movie, which is a real achievement, I think.
And Matt, it's a bit of a difficult one. Of course, there's so many films mentioned in your book, but do you have, you know, perhaps a film that really, really scared you? Perhaps something that you saw as a kid and it's always kind of in your mind somehow?
I think this is one of those questions that you get asked quite a lot, obviously, if you write a book about horror. And it's also, but the problem is not a fixed point. So what scares you when you're, you know, in your teens is completely different to what scares you when you're older. So, I mean, if I have to pick the scariest film of all time, I think a good candidate is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think that's just got this kind of, it feels like it's real. It feels like it's really happening. It's very traumatic. But if I have to pick my scariest films of all time, I look towards J-horror, things like The Ring and Dew on the Grudge. There's just something in the way, in the sort of unstoppable nature of those hauntings, that just means there's no safe space. This is just going to keep happening. It's going to keep happening. It's going to keep happening. You might be in your bed and this thing is coming to get you. And I think there's something about that that I just find really, really scary.
You're very right about that there's no space, you're safe. Because, I mean, I know today sometimes we look at the film and some might say, oh, it's camp, it can be fun. But even A Nightmare on Elm Street, I mean, is that basically you can't even sleep because it will get you when you're sleeping, you know? It's so scary.
That was the genius of Nightmare on Elm Street. I think if you look back at the film now, some aspects of it look quite dated and quite cheesy, but the idea that even when you go to sleep, you're not safe, in fact, especially when you go to sleep, is absolutely genius, because yeah, it brings a whole new arena to where you can be scared.
What about It, which, as you mentioned, huge numbers at the box office? I was even surprised when you know, the part one was released, about the success. What do you think made people connect to that film so much, especially as there was already a TV series, you know, decades ago?
That's a difficult question, actually. I think Stephen King's been growing from sort of, you know, a beloved horror writer to just a beloved writer over the years. I think It holds a certain fascination for people. It's the Pennywise the Clown is terrifying. I think the idea of fighting childhood fears that King does so well in his, you know, Stand By Me and in other films, I think that's really potent. I think Stranger Things probably piqued a bit of interest in kids running around on bikes solving mysteries in the 80s. And also the film was really well made and actually scary, and it did deliver, and also delivered in a way that you can go see if you're 15 and be scared, and you can go see if you're 35 and be scared, which very few films do. So it did a really good job.
And you've mentioned that we're living kind of, well, at least in the box office, a golden age for horror. I mean, is that you've shown that in the book with more recent examples of horror films. So you're right, it's not just about the classics, even though, of course, I love The Exorcist. I mean, it's just a brilliant film. But tell us about some of the more recent films that are featured in the book as well.
Well, the problem with something like this is that obviously it takes, you know, you finish writing a book and then there's a sort of, you know, 8 months to a year before it comes out. So the danger with that is that it's impossible to be current. But actually, because being a film critic, and also because COVID has put back so many film releases, some of the things that were the last things I included in the book are still out now. So perhaps the last film in the book is a film called St. Maud by Rose Glass, and that's out as we speak, and it's absolutely terrifying. It's a really beautiful study of kind of religion and mental health issues. And another one that was very current from 2020 is a film called Death of a Vlogger by Graham Hughes, and that's a really current sort of a vlogger is investigating if there's a ghost in his house or not. And that was from the beginning of the year, which so really, really great to include those. And, you know, it's important to try and keep up to date as well as have a wide net as possible in terms of films from around the globe. So I'm really glad those two are in there. And they're both really scary and worth seeking out.
Well, fantastic. And they're great tips for me as well, because I haven't seen them, but I'll definitely be looking out for it. And it's interesting, Matt, I think those people that don't like horror, they're becoming the minority, I would say, because some people don't understand, why do you want to be scared? But, you know, it kind of shows that we're humans in a way. And I think that's why people like to watch those films in the cinema as well, to have this kind of shared experience. Wouldn't you say so?
Yes, and I think that's something that we've been robbed of, obviously, during lockdown. One of the reasons a film out recently called Host, which is on Shudder, which is about a haunting, like a seance taking place over a Zoom phone call. And that's been really taking off. Firstly, because it's really good. Secondly, because nobody's making or releasing any films at the moment. And thirdly, because it's a shared experience. And so even though we can't sit in a cinema until recently and be scared together, everyone knows what it's like to be on a long Zoom call that doesn't go the way you expect it to. And so I think that's really resonating with people.
That was Matt Glasby, author of The Book of Horror, which is out now. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monocle.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And we're going to end the show with a classic, taken from one of my favorite horror films. This is Bernard Herrmann with the theme from Psycho. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.